Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent and author of the new book, Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. He's joined in conversation by author and co-founder of Atlas Obscura, Joshua Foer. And now let's join Dr. Sanjay Gupta and Joshua Foer.
I would say that the phenomena that you write about in this book are of enormous gravity, both individually and as a matter of public health. And I want to start by asking you to comment on something you write in the book, which is that when it comes to dementia, we're at war. What do you mean by that?
For many people, I think when they think of dementia, they do think of this sort of enemy or describing it in sort of militaristic terms with this sense that it is very difficult to win this war, that it's sort of preordained, that if dementia starts, it's this march. And I think it has to do with how often people think about the brain itself as being sort of immutable, unchangeable, a black box, you know, sort of in this hard skull of bone. And because we can't measure it, it's more like a black box. We see it by its inputs and its outputs only. It becomes something that's almost has this mystical quality to it. And there is a lot of mystical qualities to it that I still feel, even though I've been, you know, a neurosurgeon for more than two decades. But I think the metaphor of war, some people bristle at that, you know, whether it's a war on cancer or war on dementia or we are at war with something. But I thought long and hard about using that language. And I think it's galvanizing as well and inspiring, because when we describe it that way, there's also a sense that we can maybe do something about this. We not necessarily taking up arms against dementia, but utilizing strategies to with the understanding that this is not preordained.
If we could start with a basic question, why do people experience cognitive decline as they age? What is going on inside of our brains when we experience that sort of loss of memory, that slowness that so many of us feel when we get older?
You know, it's interesting. We can measure things in the brain now better than we could even a couple of decades ago, even a decade ago. And what we start to understand is that memory, and again, something you know well, cognitive decline, the process of learning, all these different things rely on so many different areas of the brain. We can point to a area of the brain, such as the hippocampus, and say memory is located here. The superior frontal gyrus could be some of your intuition, your judgment, your inhibitions, things like that. But they're all very interconnected. What seems to happen in cognitive decline is that the connections between these areas, the pathways, the roads, the trails, however, whatever metaphor or visual sort of makes sense to you, start to they don't work as well. If there are roads, there are roads that need construction or have developed blockages or whatever. It's not necessarily that the centers that these roads connect are eroded, but sometimes the roads themselves simply aren't transferring the information as well. We describe the brain as gray matter, and many of the most eloquent areas of the brain, the highest sort of value real estate areas of the brain are in fact gray, but the roads that connect them are the white matter. And oftentimes it's that white matter that's deteriorating or needs construction or has become blocked for some reason. That is typically, you know, a general way of describing cognitive decline. That's how I often describe it to my own patients, to give them that sort of the visual of what's happening there.
And how much of it is inevitable? Like, how much of it is just a function of being a human being, that this is written into the cards from day one?
Well, this is the fundamental point, frankly, Joshua, the book. I mean, there is a wear and tear, a withering away, whatever you want to call it, of certain organs, certain parts of our body, our muscles, skin changes, all these things change with age. And I would not suggest that that does not happen. Even the brain itself, from a volumetric standpoint, will start to shrink, develop more deeper crevasses, you know, within the cortex of the brain, all those things. But in terms of what is important, I think, to us, in terms of the function of the brain, I think it is not at all preordained. Now, what do I mean by that? I think one way to think about that, if you go back to sort of the road analogy and all the various trails, is if you live in this world of your brain and you are going to five or six destinations in the brain all the time. If you think about it, you're like your life. You go from work, you go to home, you go to your kid's school, you go to the grocery store, and you could go to these places with your eyes closed. You know exactly what to do when you get inside. It's very clear to you that is the sort of practice makes perfect part of your brain. The problem is that if you start to develop some of these blockages or some of the roads that you'd get from point A to point B within your brain develop some sort of blockages or need construction, do you have other roads that you could take and that you know well? If you do have lots of other roads that you could take and you've used them over the years, the blockage on your main road will be less consequential. So functionally, it's not preordained at all that you would have cognitive decline. For some reason, the metaphor of the heart seems to really make sense to people. As I was talking to even neurologists as I was writing this book, there's a concept called angiogenesis in the heart. You think of the coronary blood vessels that supply blood to the heart. If one of them becomes blocked, someone could develop have a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, something like that. But if they have plenty of angiogenesis, other blood vessels that surround those coronaries through which blood could flow and still supply blood to the muscle of the heart, then even though the coronary is blocked, that is true, functionally, someone may not notice it. If you apply that to the brain and say neurogenesis, so instead of angiogenesis, neurogenesis, you're building new paths and new trails and new roads. Even if some of your other roads become blocked, you have this what we call cognitive reserve. So again, if you were to look at the brain, if you were to image it, you might even see evidence of those blockages in the form of plaques or tangles or things like that. But cognitive decline as an outcome is not inevitable. And I just said a lot there, but I think that is a fundamental point.
So what can we do to build up that cognitive reserve, to carve out those alternate pathways in our brains?
Yeah, you know, I sort of broke it down into five sort of pillars of things, and I can sort of tick through them. But I'll preface by saying that if you were to sort of surface map your brain, like the surface of the earth, and you're looking at, you know, just all the various cities and roads and all that sort of stuff. While we use a majority of our brain at some point or another, it's not true that we use, you know, just 20% or whatever. The reality is that we haven't really cultivated or developed many areas of our brain that we could be developing. So if you want to get that cognitive reserve, developing those other areas of the brain is one of the best ways to do it. And what I mean by that is doing things that you don't normally do. Yes, practice makes perfect, but change is what really drives resiliency and reserve in the brain. And it's not hard. That's the thing that really struck me. It takes, you know, months, years to really develop an impact on your overall cardiovascular health through good diet and exercise. And all those things are very important. When it comes to the brain, the idea that you could start to develop new roads, new paths, new trails by simply eating with your non-dominant hand tonight when you eat, trying to tie your tie in the dark so you're not looking. You know, really harnessing other areas of your brain to do things that are fairly simple things that you do every day. Those are just two examples. But getting outside your comfort zone, doing something that scares you every day, whatever makes sense to you, I think is one of the most one of the easiest ways to think about developing cognitive reserve. When it comes to, you know, the pillars, the big three are clearly your diet, your movement, and your rest. When it comes to diet, there's probably the best evidence around diet and overall cognitive health and overall cardiovascular health. And it is true, I think, what is good for the heart is good for the brain. So a lot of people sort of understand the types of diets they should be following, the types of foods they should be eating when it comes to their heart health. And you could draw a lot of those same parallels when it comes to the brain health. There's a few things that may be a little different. You have to think about the brain almost as being able to develop its own form of diabetes. In fact, dementia sometimes is referred to by neuroscientists as type 3 diabetes, where you're eating certain foods, but because of a lack of insulin, you're not actually absorbing the energy from those foods. So you're eating a lot, but the brain could still be starving, not getting the energy that it needs. So that's one thing. Slashing sugar is really important because sugar ends up being one of the most toxic things overall for both cardiovascular health and impact on your overall cognitive health. The brain is 2 to 3% of your body's weight, but commands, 20% roughly of the brain's blood volume, which is one of the reasons why cardiovascular health is so important, but also why even very minor dehydration, 2 to 3% dehydration, can have almost an immediate effect on cognitive health. And replacing that dehydration can quickly restore that as well. As far as foods, I avoided superfoods in the book as a term, except to say that there really is no such thing. But, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. But I think when it comes to the brain, it's berries. And, I can run through the various compounds, but you're looking for compounds that can actually do a good job of crossing the blood-brain barrier, help actually develop scaffolding within the brain to support the neural framework that I'm sort of describing. I'll just say quickly, because I don't want to filibuster you here, but the other thing that has a lot of evidence behind it is movement. And I use the word movement instead of exercise. And I think the way to sort of think about this for me is that it's not so much that activity is the cure for something, more so that inactivity is the disease. So you exercise, get your endurance, whatever you like to do, but it's more about not becoming inactive. Every time you're about to sit, maybe ask yourself, do I really need to be sitting, trying to move throughout the day? A body in motion is a body that is signaling to the brain, I want to be here. I am here. And the body and the brain can turn on the defense mechanisms that help keep it healthier, help reduce the chance of cognitive decline. So I could talk about rest, but I'll throw in the mix rest, finding your purpose in life. And there's all sorts of hacks that I've learned that really make a difference. And then just the idea of social connection and how important that is and how much you see social connection in communities where there is very little dementia. So there's a lot of different things to do there, and I can get more specific, but those are the broad sort of brushstrokes, Joshua.
Yeah, and I will say I was really inspired by some of the sort of nuts and bolts practical advice you've got in the book. And so much of it, at like the highest level, feels like advice one would give about not just how to keep your brain sharp, but how to live a good life. Eat well, sleep well, be physically active, be social. And those are activities that have been a natural part of human life for most of the time that humans have been walking around on this planet. And I want to ask you, to what extent do you think cognitive decline is a byproduct of a mismatch between the environment that our hunter-gatherer ancestors were built for and these very different modern lives that we lead today?
I think it's a large part of it. I mean, I think that's a really interesting way of sort of describing it. From an evolutionary standpoint, I find it fascinating to sort of look at how we evolved to live the sort of life that we should be living versus, because of the various resources in a place like the United States, a life of leisure, a life of convenience, the life that we are leading. A couple of years ago, I spent several weeks down in Bolivia, essentially living with this indigenous tribe called the Chimane tribe. And part of the reason I wanted to go be with them was because there had been this article written in The Lancet basically saying this is a group of people who seemingly have the healthiest hearts in the world. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. I, you know, as a coming from a family that has a history of heart disease, what would it be that would allow this tribe of people to have the healthiest hearts in the world? And you may think, well, they're an indigenous tribe. They're hunter-gatherers. Of course, they have the healthiest hearts in the world. Actually, not true. It seems that heart disease has affected just about every population living on Earth. But part of the reason that they seem to have the healthiest hearts in the world, hardly any diabetes, hardly any dementia, although that was, you know, they were still starting to study that, was because of exactly what you're saying. It was a match between their evolutionary patterns and the lifestyle they led. The types of foods that they ate were arguably the best fuels for the human body, both what they ate and how they consumed it, how they moved, how they slept. When, you know, they spent most of their day either lying when they slept or standing and walking. They hardly ever sat. And it was interesting because I thought to myself, there was these euphemisms going around saying sitting is the new smoking, for example. And I thought, well, that's cute, but you know, does that really mean anything? And I came back and I started to really pour into the literature and look at these articles. And it was fascinating to find that, you know, in these cultures, you really only sat when you got old. Other than that, you know, young people were again either lying or sitting, or lying or standing and walking. And when you got old and you started to sit, it was like this teleological thing, meaning that signals were then sent as a result of your sitting to the body. And I'm simplifying here, but the signals were, okay, it's come closer to the end of my life. I'm getting old. I'm sitting a lot. Therefore, you can start to shut down the perimeter defenses. The body's constantly fighting a mutated cell over here, a pathogen over here. You probably fought, you know, several pathogens just in the time that we've been talking, and it did, and your body did a good job. But as you start to sit more and more and the perimeter defenses go down, it's almost like the body is signaling to the internal systems that, hey, you know, it's getting to be time. So if you sit a lot and you're not trying to signal that to the body, that becomes a problem. And that's a little bit of the mismatch that we're talking about. That example is around movement, the types of food that we eat. Going back to sugar, I mean, we got sugar a couple times a year, you know, when fruit fell from the trees, and even honey was protected by the bees. And now we eat about 130 pounds of sugar a year on average. Our body simply cannot metabolize that. It's like a tsunami wave that hits the liver, and it's these sugar molecules that really churn out low density lipoproteins, which are the bad kind of cholesterol. That is a mismatch as well. The way that we sleep. When I was with this Chimane tribe, I set up this little tent in the middle of their encampment. This is in the Amazon rainforest. About 9:30 at night, I mean, there was no lights. And you just start to hear this heavy breathing and snoring all around you. And it was about 6:30 in the morning with the call and answer of the rooster out in the forest that people started to wake up. Turns out if you don't have, you know, one of these to stare at all night, you get some pretty good sleep. Again, that's an example of mismatch. They have incredible, incredible social connection in their lives. And, you know, again, it goes without saying we are social creatures. People know that. But it's not just a question of having the connection. It's a question of the profundity of that connection. How deep is it? And I really arrived at this. I was talking to my own parents, and because I've been thinking about them a lot during this whole COVID time. It's just been so hard for them to interact with people. They're very social people. We FaceTime all the time. But this loneliness researcher named Stephanie Cacioppo, who's living in Oregon right now, she said to me, she said, the next time you talk to your parents, ask them for help. I said, okay, tell me more. Interesting, you know, piece of advice. Ask for some sort of help, anything. Because if you ask for help, it immediately creates a more profound relationship. They're my parents. I'm their kid. No matter what, they still want to take care of me, even though I'm 50 years old. That's the truth. So when I was writing the book, I thought to myself, how do I start to really boil this down? And I said, if you go for a brisk walk with a close friend and you talk about your problems, that sort of starts to hit at all these things that are really associated with the brain getting the positive signals to really induce good cognitive health. Why discuss your problems? Because show a little vulnerability. Perhaps you're asking for a little bit of help. Whatever the case may be, it leads to a more profound relationship. So you want the relationships, but you want them to be meaningful as well. So, you know, those are the sorts of things that I was looking at, not just the what of what to do, but also to some extent the why of how it works from an evolutionary standpoint, but also from what's happening in the brain.
You're listening to Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent and author of the new book, Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. He's joined in conversation by Joshua Foer on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Would love if you would share some of the things that you do on a daily basis that are, you know, that you do for the sake of making sure that you stay sharp.
You know, just because it's just us here, right, Joshua? So I'll just be totally
just us.
I want to be honest. This has been a tough year. These past 12 months, you know, I've been so head down, in COVID and covering this, that I don't know that I would be honest if I said I was totally practicing what I preach with all these things. Certainly not when it comes to rest and things like that. I have not been sleeping enough, you know, but it's by no means suggesting that I don't understand or value the importance of it. But what I do try is to really think about my cognitive health on a daily basis. So for example, the brisk walks with a close friend talking about problems turns out to be very COVID friendly as well. We're outside, we're walking, you know, for around people, we can wear masks, but we can talk and things like that. So that's something that I've been doing on a very regular basis. I've gotten really good about my diet and understanding how to think about the foods that I'm eating as not just nourishing my body and giving me calories and energy, but also nourishing my brain. And then also thinking that the nourishment of the brain isn't just from the food that you eat, but from every experience you have, from every visual, everything you're taking in from a sensory standpoint. So I do think about that. I meditate on a regular basis, and I practice a form of meditation known as analytical meditation, which is not like single point meditation where you're focusing on a single thing, or the type of meditation I could never do, which was to sort of just wipe your mind clean. I just found that I couldn't do it. Actually leaning into something that you're either really trying to solve, a problem you're trying to solve, an issue that's, you know, has consumed you, a book that you've just read, whatever it may be, and really thinking about it, putting it inside a bubble, letting it float around, being able to spin it around, I found was just so nourishing to my brain. Those are some examples of the things that I'm doing. I know the things that I should be doing. I'm collected the evidence, and I'm honest about things that I think don't have evidence yet, but make enough sense to me to continue doing. There's very little harm and potentially a lot of benefit. And I try and do as much of those things as possible.
Could you give us a little more on what it means to eat Sanjay style?
Yeah. You know, I use the acronym SHARP from the book because I realize when you're writing a book about memory, you do want to make things memorable to some extent to make them easy to remember, as you well know. But SHARP was, S was to slash sugar, which again, I've talked about, but I just find so interesting. I did a 60 Minutes piece on this a couple of years ago about the toxicity of sugar. And if there's one thing that I would recommend more than anything else, people talk about cutting down red meat, adding more, whatever, you know, and those are all important things, whatever it may be. But I think the sugar part of it is the thing that has been the biggest mismatch, to use your sort of contextualization. I really believe that. I think if you can cut sugar, because our bodies just weren't designed to be able to metabolize sugar the way that we eat it, that'll be a big part of the win in terms of how you actually eat in a way that I think is conducive to good cognitive health. I mentioned the hydration earlier, and this is, again, fascinating to me. We live in a society where we have plenty of resources. We have plenty of food and plenty of water. Most of us do. We also recognize that the area of the brain, that sort of that pang, that sensation, if I need something, that area of the brain doesn't distinguish really well between hunger and thirst, which I found fascinating. A lot of times when you feel that pang, whatever, that feeling in your brain, you need something, and you live in a resource-intensive environment, you tend to eat instead of drink. And as a result, in wealthy countries like the United States, we tend to walk around chronically overstuffed and dehydrated. That's true for most of us. So simply focusing on hydration and recognizing that even 2-3% dehydration can have an impact on cognitive health acutely makes a big difference. If there's one thing that I do suggest adding, I do focus on the omega-3s. There's conflicting evidence on this, and I reviewed a lot of it. I mean, there's 160 papers that we reference in various parts of the book. But, you know, I did sort of approach this from the standpoint of, first of all, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. That is true. Some of these are just hard studies to do, Joshua. How do you really do a study showing omega-3 fatty acids have an impact on cognitive health over decades? Food studies are hard to do because how do you exclude other foods, certain populations, and then follow people over two decades relying on their memory in terms of what they actually ate? Nevertheless, I think when you look at the components of omega-3 fatty acids, you find components that can cross the blood-brain barrier and actually help build the scaffolding necessary for the real estate you're trying to develop in the brain, as I was describing earlier. And then restricting portions really is the last sort of point. We simply eat too much. You know, if you can start cutting your meals down by a third in terms of overall caloric intake, for most of us, not everybody, some are very good about this, but if you can, there's a lot of data that's come out of the mimicking fasting literature. And I think some of it's very fascinating, but I think as a starting point for most people, instead of going to some sort of fasting mimicking metabolic state, I think just reducing portions makes a big difference.
What about drugs? Are the medicines, and I don't mean of the illegal sort, I mean pharmaceuticals, medicines, are the medicines that we're taking for anxiety, depression, sleep, so many Americans are taking these kinds of drugs, are they hurting our brains over the long term?
I think that, you know, for some people, these are necessary medications. I mean, there are people who have deficiencies in certain neurotransmitters, which are becoming more easily and objectively measured. But for the most part, yeah, I think that when it comes to certain medications, some of these components that are found in antihistamines, for example, certain sleep medications, for example, at least in the short term, they can have an impact on your cognitive health. I think and that's the bad news. I think what is better news is that none of this seems to cause, almost none of it seems to cause fixed deficiencies in your cognitive health going forward. The process of neurogenesis can happen so quickly and really at any age that you can overcome most of these types of insults to your brain, whether it be through drugs, whether it even be through trauma. And again, I don't want to simplify this. I take care of patients with traumatic brain injury. That is my day job. But so much, you know, we thought that neurogenesis only occurred in young children whose brains were still developing or people who have had spinal cord or brain injuries. And now we know it can happen in the healthy brain as well. So overcoming insults from any of these things that you're mentioning, I think is quite possible.
You know, one of the subjects that is noticeably absent from your recommendation is so-called brain training, right? Like apps like Lumosity, for example, which I've personally been pretty skeptical of for a while, skeptical of their value, of how transferable the sorts of skills that you're developing when you're doing that kind of an activity might be. And I would love for you to weigh in on the idea of, you know, brain fitness, brain training.
Yeah. I was going to put it in there, but I forgot, actually.
Yeah. You can use that. You can use that line in every one of these.
Never gets old. Right. No, you know, we did. I talked about brain training a bit in the book, and it was interesting because right around the time that I started working on this, there was a you may remember this, this game came out called Double Decision. And there was a lot that was written about it. There was a big pullout in the Wall Street Journal, and it really revolved around this conference, one of the Alzheimer's conferences, where they talked about the impact of this particular brain training game in the context of brain training as a whole. And they found two things that I thought were very interesting. One is that people who played this game, and basically the game, there's various scenarios, but you know, one of them is you're driving a car down the road and you have to identify certain types of other cars by color, whether they're convertible, things like that. And you do this more quickly over time. And it was this idea that what is more important, sort of block memory training sort of games or speed processing games? If you had to pick a certain type of exercise, is one of those better at decreasing the likelihood that you're going to develop dementia later on in life? And at least from the data that they presented, it seemed that, first of all, there could be an impact on overall likelihood of developing dementia, and that out of the two, speed processing was actually more important as opposed to block memory sort of training games, which I thought was very interesting. And you know, we included some of that data in the book. But what I think kept coming up and talking to people like Richard Isaacson and others who have, you know, really made a lifetime of doing this incredible work was a concept that we talked about earlier, which is that you can get really good at doing these things, whether it be playing the game or doing the crossword puzzle, whatever it may be. And that is the practice makes perfect. That is keeping that road that you love to drive whistle clean. You know, you can just drive that road again with your eyes closed. But you're not doing a lot to cultivate other real estate, develop other real estate in the brain. If that road stays open your whole life, you never have a problem, that's great. It's not ideal even because there's a lot of joy, I think, from cultivating other parts of your brain. You see patterns that you would have otherwise maybe missed. You connect things that maybe wouldn't have been so easily connected. That's just novel learning. And I think one way to have novel learning is to just have other parts in your brain that you can immediately bounce ideas off of. You're just doing this internally. You're not thinking about doing this, but it just happens. So the brain training, I think, is really good at making those pathways that you use on a regular basis work really well, but they don't give you the real estate. And if one of those pathways over time does become blocked or needs construction, you may not have the other roads to sort of get around it. So yes, advantages, yes, benefits. I don't throw a lot of cold water on it. A lot of neuroscientists do. But I explain, I think, what the benefits of brain training exercises like that are. If you're going to do them, what the goal should be in terms of speed processing, and why just doing something different, totally different, might make a lot more sense. If the goal is to have fun now, experience the joy of what your brain can do now, and also protect it for later.
So, you know, we are here virtually in the nation's capital, and I want to ask you about policy. What do you think can be done from a public policy perspective to promote cognitive health?
You know, I think we're starting to see it. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I started my training in neurosurgery in 1993. And, you know, at that time, there was the NINDS, and there was a modest amount of funding that went into that. But I think as we've seen the number of people who have developed neurodegenerative diseases over the last 20, 25 years, you are starting to see some corresponding policy changes. It's nowhere comparable to other things like cancer, like heart disease. Although when it comes to stroke, and even when it comes to what we've seen over the last year with long hauling COVID symptoms, you are starting to see more interest, more funding, more research going behind that. I think, you know, I think there's a fundamental problem, Joshua, sometimes in science, and that is that we've been so focused on the idea of what likely is driving certain types of dementia like Alzheimer's based on this structural sort of concept of amyloid plaque causing, you know, the gumming up the brain, tangles of tau within neurons, making the neurons less likely to function as well, and therefore focusing on treatments that would eliminate amyloid plaque and hoping that that would either stall or even reverse, you know, Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. And trial after trial has proven or shown that that really did not work very well at all. So I think that's been frustrating. And for some people, that area of research has been become known as the valley of death. You cannot cross that valley when it comes to overall cognitive health research. That is starting to change. And you have these other funds like the Dementia Discovery Fund and things like that. Bill Gates has contributed to that. The AARP has contributed to that. You're getting these other organizations that are now starting to really put a focus on that. And that is driving, I think, public policy to some extent as well. It's almost the private sector driving back some of the public policy around this. So it's changing, certainly too slowly for people who have dealt with this in their own family. But I think it is happening.
So before we open this up to questions, I want to end the Josh interview part of this with hopefully some optimism. Your book ends with a chapter titled The Bright Future. And I want to just give you a chance to talk about what makes you optimistic about all of this.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think that there's going to be a lot of focus from a scientific perspective on all the things that that worry us about the brain, these neurodegenerative diseases, or just the general lack of optimization of brain health. But what I think, you know, what inspires me is that if you think about disease overall in this country, chronic disease, depending on what model you look at, you could make the argument that 2/3 of it roughly is totally preventable. I find that to be horrifying and inspiring at the exact same time. You know, it's one of these things where so many of these diseases, including the diseases that lead to decreased cognitive health, are preventable. We didn't really think that way 10, 20 years ago when it came to the brain or even the heart. You thought you had a fixed number of these cells, you drained the cash, and that was it. It was preordained, as you sort of mentioned earlier. But now we know that we can, through these lifestyle interventions, make a difference. Again, I want to be careful here because my whole life has been the scientific method, and I like to present the data around this. But if you look at cultures and places around the world, you certainly find societies where you don't see the level of disease by a long shot that we have in the United States. And a lot of times these are almost always cultures that don't have the resources that we have. So what do they do? What can we learn from them? And will it make a difference here? And I think the answer to the last one is yes. So that, you know, I find that inspiring. It's not very hard. The idea that your brain could stay sharp throughout its entire life and even grow sharper like a Ginsu knife. The more you use it, the sharper it gets. I tell the story in the book, Joshua, of something that had an impact on me. I was on call one night and I was operating and my residents came in and they said some version of this. There is a 93-year-old man who has a hemorrhage in his brain. And, you know, honestly, you know, I heard 93 years old, the hemorrhage in the brain. Is this something that as a neurosurgeon, as a brain surgeon, is this something that I should be a patient that I should be caring for? And is this a patient that who should get an operation? There's all these, you know, medical, ethical questions that sort of come up. Do I put this person through an operation if there's a little chance of survival? You know, all those things, all this is percolating through my head. And tell me more, what happened to him? Well, it turns out he was on his roof with a leaf blower and he was blowing the leaves off of his roof. I said, 93-year-old guy was on his roof with the leaf blower. I mean, that, and he fell. And I thought, wow, I mean, he sounds like a very active 93-year-old guy to have done that. So I went to go see him. He was, you know, had this brain bleed, but he was still, you know, able to talk to me and stuff. And he was, you know, I fell off this roof, had this, you know, and, but very sharp guy. Took him to the operating room. And when you're doing these operations, you know, you're basically, the whole goal is to take pressure off the brain. The brain, unlike any other organ, again, is in the skull. Like other organs can swell and you got room. The brain can't, that has no room to swell. So you got to take pressure off of the brain. And that's basically just removing bone and then finding the blood collection and removing that, which I did. And then for a few moments after I've removed all the blood, you get to look at the brain. You get to just stare at this 3.5 pound of flesh. And that's the mystical part where you're reminded, like, you know, every joy, every pain, every experience, every learning you've ever had is somehow bound into that flesh. It's amazing to me still to even talk about.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent and author of the new book, Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. He's joined in conversation by Joshua Foer. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But anyways, I'm looking at this 93-year-old's brain, who's this highly functional guy, had been blowing leaves off the roof, which is a bad idea, but it just speaks to his function. And what do you think I saw? I saw a brain that looked like a 93-year-old's brain. It was small. It was more shrunken. It had those deeper crevasses that I was mentioning. The brain ages. We all age. As much as we'd like to think that we don't or we won't, we do. But his brain was still very sharp. I went to talk to the family. I said everything went well. Went to go see him the next day. He was sitting up. I'll never forget. He's looking at his phone. And I always look, now that I'm 50 years old, I always look to see if someone is wearing reading glasses or not. He was not wearing reading glasses, did not have hearing aids in, just little things that you notice. And he was reading his phone, and he was, you know, he had a bandage on and, you know, on his head from the operation. And what are you doing? You know, just following these elections in West Africa. He had been a volunteer doing this relief work in West Africa earlier in life and got very interested in the politics of this region of the world, 93 years old. And he was sitting there studying the election results coming out of West Africa. Sounded like he was doing really well, talking to him, moving everything. His headache is gone. Everything is good. And I said, so, you know, what'd you learn? I mean, what has this been like for you, this whole thing? I mean, 93 years old, you fell. He goes, I think what I've learned is I should not blow leaves off the roof anymore. And I thought, yes, this is real time learning. But, you know, I tell the story because, it's not preordained. The brain changes. Of course it does. It will age. Of course it will. But losing its function, it's probably one of the only organs that can reliably grow stronger and sharper as you age. I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that. Your senses may diminish. You can't run maybe as fast as you used to. Maybe your vision and your hearing will diminish. Most people, it does happen for them. But the overall things that matter, the ability to find joy, understanding the purpose of memory, which is, you know, a fundamental topic that I know you know a lot about, but the memories that we keep are the memories to tell the story of us. That is my life narrative, those memories. And the fact that I can still retain them, I can still play those films in my head and live that life, I think is really, it's optimistic, it's inspiring. I think it inspired me when I started talking to neuroscientists around the world about this, and hopefully it inspires anybody else who reads it.
That's wonderful. We've got a bunch of questions here from the audience, which I'm being fed a list of, selected questions. And I'd love to just get down as many of these as we possibly can. So to start, Jason asks, if you have a strong family history of dementia and perhaps genetically inclined, is it still possible to grow your cognitive reserve with diet, exercise, et cetera?
Yeah. No, Jason, this is the question. So, you know, I don't know what the genetic risk factors are, and there are, you know, I got a whole section in the book about what the genetic risk factors are and whether or not you should get them even tested and how you should sort of think through that. If you have an allele for EPO3 versus EPO4, all these things, you'll find this. And I think it's worth just being knowledgeable about what genetic risk factors really mean. But the reserve is the key part of your question, I think. Can, you know, we know that for so many people who develop a dementia like Alzheimer's disease, the changes in their brain are occurring decades before the symptoms are occurring. If you were to image their brain and objectively measure it in some way and not know anything else about the patient, you may say, well, this looks like somebody who might have Alzheimer's disease or have some form of dementia. And in fact, they're totally cognitively intact. The point being that despite the genetic risk factors that put you at risk of developing plaque or developing the other things that are associated with these diseases, if you have all those other roads and those paths and those trails and those cities that you've developed by eating with your non-dominant hand and tying your tie in the dark and doing something that scares you every day, you're going to have the reserve and the resiliency to be able to not have a decline in cognitive function as a result. Do you still have the disease? Perhaps. Objectively, one could say that. Is it having an impact on you? Hopefully not. So that's what I mean. Can we run away from our genes? Not necessarily, but can we dramatically lessen or even totally eliminate the impact? I think so, especially when it comes to the brain.
Heather asks, do you think that the prolonged low to moderate anxiety of the pandemic is having a negative effect on our brains?
Yeah, I think that is probably the case. I mean, I don't think it's a permanent impact. I think there's plenty of evidence to show how quickly we can heal the brain, and in order to heal the body, you got to heal the brain. So healing the brain first. I would look at it like this, Heather. People talk about reducing stress in their lives or eliminating stress in their lives, and I think that is not. First of all, I think it's an overly audacious goal, and I don't think it's actually a very productive goal. Truth is that we need a certain amount of stress in our lives. Gets us out of bed in the morning, gets my three tween and teen girls to actually take their Zoom tests on, you know, online and whatever it may be. But it is the incessant nature of it that I think is so problematic. And I think that that's been a problem this past year with this pandemic. I've certainly felt it. You know, if you say, okay, stress is not the enemy, it's just the constant nature of it. Maybe the goal is not to say, hey, I need to just eliminate stress, but to truly find these ebbs and flows during my day where I can have moments where I'm not stressed, whether it's immersing yourself in nature, meditating, whatever it is for you, exercise, you know, whatever it is, having your own time, don't try and eliminate the stress. Just find the ebb and flow so that you can benefit from good stress and not be harmed by the bad stress.
So another question here comes in. What is the effect of stress on cognitive decline? I mean, what is actually going on? Why does stress make it hard for us to think, and how does it affect us over the long term?
Yeah, well, you know, you do have, again, these measurable now, objective measurable impact on neurotransmitters and the ability to see what these stress hormones like cortisol are actually doing to the brain. One of the most objective things is actually you do see at least temporary shrinking of areas like the hippocampus and sometimes increased activity in the amygdala, which is the emotional center of the brain. Amygdala, emotional center of the brain, hippocampus, and frontal lobes are going to be your more memory and your judgment areas of the brain. So what happens is if you got a fired up amygdala and decreased in inhibition, judgment, memory, you become a more emotional sort of creature who doesn't really experience life fully or remember it fully. You tend to be much more reactive to things as a result of that, emotional. If you do make decisions, oftentimes they bypass the judgment areas of the brain. So you may react strongly to something, you see something, or somebody tells you, if you eat that cheeseburger, you're going to have a heart attack. And then you're like, I'm not going to eat anything for a week, right? That's the amygdala talking. It's not a good decision. That's a terrible decision. And so you have an intense reaction to this very stressful sort of thing that you've heard, but it's not a well thought out reaction. And that's sort of the impact of stress. You're not learning things properly. You're not using judgment to execute plans properly. And it's really because of the impact on these various centers of the brain like that. It also probably decreases those white matter tracks, makes them run less efficiently. So your city centers are still there in the brain, but you're just having a harder time communicating between them.
We've got another question here to the point of stress. How are you personally coping with the ongoing pandemic? As CNN's chief medical correspondent, what keeps you up at night and what gives you hope?
You know, it's been a tough time. You know, I mean, I just want to be honest here, and I already was honest about the fact that I haven't been as good about practicing what I preach in this book. I know that I should. It's been stressful in ways that surprised me. I feel like, you know, when you look at a problem like a medical problem, in this case, a public health problem, you tend to immediately think of how to define the problem and then hopefully to offer a plan to address the problem. I've always believed, I think, Joshua, that there is this concept of reciprocal altruism. The idea, you know, for whatever reason, we evolved in a way that when I do something good for somebody else, it actually feels good. I mean, it's true, right? You do something nice for somebody else, you feel good. Now, why would we have evolved that way? I mean, that's not the survival of the fittest sort of idea that Darwin actually never said that, by the way, but that idea that it's all about the individual, that rugged individualism was never really the thing. It was always reciprocal altruism, that it feels good to do good. I bring that up because what has stressed me, I think, during this last year is that I think there's been times when we haven't seen that, you know, tell people that if you put on two ear loops when you go outside because you don't want to spread the virus, and if you do so, you could be part of a movement that could save 70,000 lives. That's according to some of the models that came out of the IHME. Two ear loops, save 70,000 lives. Be part of a movement. You know, how many times in your life do you get to save a life? And you have a significant percentage of people who say, you know what? I ain't going to do it. I'll pass. That was stressful to me because it was like an existential stress almost. Like, where do we go as a species from here if the basic concepts of like things like reciprocal altruism for some reason aren't being abided by? I'm simplifying. And people are probably shouting at their screens saying, it's not human nature. This is politics and, you know, whatever it may be. Sure. The end of the day, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have died of this pandemic, and that's the truth, you know. So that I find stressful. What I find inspiring is that, you know, there's still, having said that, there's still incredible people out there. I mean, I remember early on in the pandemic, you know, going to the grocery store and people, you know, even wiping the handle as they go through for the next guy. It turns out maybe fomites aren't as big a source of transmission as we thought, but it was just the idea. People would call us and say, hey, we're going to the grocery store. Can we get you things? It can bring out the best in people as well. I think I was a sci-fi sort of kid, you know, and I loved those sorts of books when I was growing up. And I always thought, you know, what would be the thing that would galvanize the world together, all cultures of the world? And I thought, well, that would be an alien attack of some sort, right? People of the earth come together to deal with this, you know, this alien threat. Well, the pandemic was sort of like that. The pandemic was sort of, in some ways, it had the same embodiment of this alien threat. And many people did come together around this. It did galvanize people, and that inspired me. We're going to get through this, and we're going to be better and stronger and better prepared, hopefully, for the next time something this might happen. And I find that inspiring as well.
We got one last question from Janice. She asks, how do we best approach loved ones when we feel that they may be experiencing cognitive decline, dementia, or Alzheimer's? It's a tough question. Many folks may be in denial and also do not want their independence adversely impacted. What's your advice?
This was a big question. And, you know, I talked to a lot of people about this. I spent some time in the Netherlands while writing this book at a place called the Dementia Village. That's a colloquial name, but it's a true village that's been set up in outside of Amsterdam for people with dementia. And they've created an entire town. And it's all about basically allowing people to live a as normal a life for them as possible. But a lot of it was exactly this question that you're raising, which is, you know, the communications between people and the idea of correcting people when they are in denial or they are repeating themselves or doing something over and over again, whatever it may be, turns out to not be a very good strategy to try and educate people at that level if they already have the onset of dementia is not a very good strategy. I think the idea of inspiring people about what is possible through scaring them about what they may no longer be able to achieve, I think is probably the biggest key. There's an entire chapter in the book about scenarios where, you know, you have a certain situation when you're talking to a loved one about what may seem like either early onset or moderate cognitive impairments, and how you should sort of navigate through those scenarios. And it depends, you know, some of it is dependent on the relationship that you already have with the person. But as a general rule, trying to correct people or educate people about their own impairment or their own disease is probably not a good strategy.
Well, Dr. Gupta, this has been a pleasure. Thank you for being here with all of us. Thank you for writing this terrific book. Thank which you. I highly recommend. Comes with many, many great recommendations on it. Bill Gates on the cover, among many others. And I think people will enjoy it. And thank you.
Thanks, Chad. And thanks for your time. It's very kind of you to take time out of your evening and do this. I really appreciate it. And I'm a big fan of yours. So thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent and author of the new book, Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. He was joined in conversation by author and co-founder of Atlas Obscura, Joshua Foer. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.